Blog Talk Radio.
We'll be right back.
something called the Alhambra Decree, or the Edict of Expulsion. What that did was it told all Jews living in Spain and Portugal, the Iberian Peninsula, that whole region of the world, that they had 4 months' time to either convert to Catholicism, which was the state religion there. If they didn't do that, they had to get out. So thousands upon thousands left. The ones that stayed behind were forced to convert. They were known as the conversos, the converts. Many of those who converted, though, only outwardly pretended to do so. You know, in their homes, in secret, they continued to practice the rituals of Judaism, knowing if they were caught at that point in history, they'd be arrested, they'd be tried, and if they were found guilty, they'd probably be burned at the stake. Very unfortunate. We follow the ones that left. They really went all over the world, but our story follows the Jews who went into Amsterdam, Holland. The Dutch were very accepting people. They didn't care so much about religion as much as they cared about money and whether or not you could contribute to the economy. The Jews were good merchants, brought in good money, so they were welcome to stay. So when we look at history, we find that when the Dutch would go and explore the New World, that many Jewish families tended to follow them. Crossed the Atlantic, went down to the Caribbean, settled in Jamaica, St. Thomas, Barbados, Curacao. Curacao has the oldest synagogue in the Western Hemisphere. They also went to this place called Recife on the northeastern coast of Brazil. Many times, though, the Jews would arrive down there, find that Spain and Portugal, the Spanish Inquisition, were also already there, forcing all the Jews to either leave or convert. This went on for hundreds of years. And it happened in 1654. Portugal recaptured Recife. All the Jews that were living there were told to get out or convert to Catholicism. So hundreds once again left, going really everywhere. Many hopefully heading back to Amsterdam because life was better there. One ship containing 23 Jewish individuals set sail from Recife with Amsterdam as their goal. But through a series of unfortunate events, their ship doesn't make it. It gets stranded in the Caribbean. And it's not until a French merchant ship comes to their aid, says, well, you can board our ship, but we're not going back to Amsterdam. We're sailing north instead to New Amsterdam, which is today what we call New York. So 1654, the first few dozen Jews arrive in New Amsterdam. They found the oldest Hebrew congregation in the United States, Congregation Sherith Israel, which still exists today on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Now, what makes them different is they are the oldest congregation in the U.S. We are the oldest physical synagogue structure because none of their original buildings exist anymore. So the governor there, a man by the name of Peter Stuyvesant, the governor of New Amsterdam, did not like any minorities. He repeatedly tried to get the Jews kicked out, but they were good merchants. So a letter from the Dutch West Indies Company told him he didn't have that power. But other Jews were not allowed into New Amsterdam for some time after that. So that takes our story 4 years into the future, to 1658. This time we have to go back down to the Caribbean and we go to Barbados, where all these merchant ships are coming into port and they're talking about this new colony, this lively experiment, as it's known. That lively experiment turns out to be Rhode Island and Providence plantations, founded by Roger Williams, is probably the most well-known name. Then there's also Anne Hutchinson, who founded Portsmouth. And then there's Dr. John Clark, who founded Newport in 1639. Those three believed anyone could come to their colony, this colony of Rhode Island, regardless of their religion, no matter what God they believed in, and the government can't be involved whatsoever. It was true separation of church and state, something really unheard of at that point in history. So down in Barbados, 15 Jewish families hear about this place and they want to see it for themselves. It's important to point out that they were not kicked out of Barbados. They left on their own free will with Newport, Rhode Island as their goal. They arrive here in 1658, settle down in the Point District, what we call Easton's Point, right off the bridge there. It's the oldest part of town. They rent apartments from, you know, homes from Quakers that are already living here, and they worship in one another's homes for quite some time. It's not until 20 years after they arrive here, in 1677, that they make any property purchase whatsoever, which kind of really finalizes that they're going to stay here. They purchase a very small plot of land about two blocks up this street at the top of what is now Toro Street, right across from the Viking Hotel. A small plot of land to use as a burial ground to bury their loved ones. It's the second oldest Jewish cemetery in the United States. You can't go in it today, unfortunately, but you can see inside and you can see the names on the headstones and you'll see Sephardic last names, names that originate in Spain and Portugal, the Iberian Peninsula. So you'll look in and you'll see Lopez, Rodriguez Rivera, Satius, Mendez, Toro, because that was the original ancestry that first came here in the 1650s. From there, I'm going to fast forward, excuse me, to the mid-1700s. That's the golden age of Newport. We've got a rich, deep natural harbor. It's one of the five busiest seaports in the colonies at that point. Huge shipping industry. Rum is huge. The British can't get enough of Newport rum. There are 22 distilleries on the harborfront alone in colonial days. the Jews, merchants, do very well here. They're members of this society, accepted. They worship. They can freely worship. And they finally grow to the point where they say, you know what, we need a real synagogue. We need a real rabbi, a real spiritual figurehead. So they look for help from Congregation Sherith Israel in New York to send over a rabbi. No rabbis want to come to the wilds of Newport, Rhode Island at that point. Still kind of hard to access. I mean, there's no highways or bridges getting here by any means. There's no rabbinical schools in Rhode Island at that point, so they're kind of at a loss. So the congregation kind of sends word out every which way they can to look for a rabbi. Eventually it gets overseas and gets into Europe, where a young 19-year-old man in Amsterdam, Holland, by the name of Isaac Toro, answers the call. 19, he's a rabbinical student studying to become a rabbi and says, I'll go. he leaves, crosses the Atlantic, comes to Newport, never becomes a full rabbi because he left rabbinical school, and he becomes really the first spiritual figurehead of the congregation here, and they love him here in town. They call him Reverend Toro. One, because he was revered, and secondly, because he never was a full rabbi. So they also need an architect to help build their synagogue. Colonial America, there's no architectural schools here yet. Everyone is self-taught. But they find an Englishman living here in Newport by the name of Peter Harrison. He is well known because he has studied over in Europe. He's accumulated a vast architectural knowledge. He's known for designing churches in Boston and in Cambridge. In Newport, he's known because he designed the brick marketplace down on Thames Street. He also did the Redwood Library up on Bellevue Avenue, which is the oldest lending library in the United States. So they want him. And he hesitantly accepts because he admits that he's a Quaker, that he's never stepped foot into a synagogue, and that he's never seen a synagogue. He doesn't want to do it in injustice because he doesn't know what it looks like. And truth be told, the majority of the Jews here in Newport had never seen a synagogue either. They'd been here for over 100 years at this point, several generations having never worshipped inside a synagogue. So once again, kind of at a loss. How do you design something that you've never seen before? Luckily, the congregation has a few new members, and it's also got Isaac Toro, who had seen synagogues over in Amsterdam. So they work with Peter Harrison, and this is what they come up with. This is loosely based off of the Great Portuguese Synagogue in Amsterdam, even though this is just one-tenth the size of it. They start building in 1759. It takes 4 years to build. Records tell us that Peter Harrison did not accept a dime worth of payment. He considered this a labor of love and a gift to the Jewish community here in Newport. So opening night was December 2nd, 1763. The door to the synagogue was open. The entire Newport community was invited to come in to not only see Harrison's newest design, but also to celebrate the first night of Hanukkah. They lit this menorah right here, as every piece of brass you see in here is original to the synagogue, as is every piece of woodwork that you see as well. This is all original. So after that night, the congregation flourished for 13 years, because 13 years later comes 1776 and the Revolution. The British sailed into Newport Harbor, blockaded it, shutting off every penny coming into and leaving the city. People were obviously terrified, and because of that, over half of Newport's population left during that time period, never to come back again. British came in, they occupied Newport for 3.5 years, destroying close to 400 of Newport's original homes and main architecture. The synagogue went virtually untouched because Isaac Toro, knowing the British wouldn't destroy one of their own buildings, hands this over to the British Army. And for those 3.5 years, this was used as a hospital annex for British soldiers, and untouched during the war. excuse me. After the war ended, people did not come back here. Newport never fully economically recovered. There was enough of a congregation into the early 1800s to stay active, but with no new people coming in, the congregation eventually died out, or they all moved away. So with no Jewish people here, the doors to the synagogue were locked for most of the 1800s. This went virtually almost unused. It was used for some government purposes over the years because perhaps this was one of the only buildings left after the war that was large enough. The keys were left
to a Quaker family, the Gould family, who took care of this for three generations during the 1800s while this wasn't in use. It really was not until the late 1800s when an influx of, you know, of European immigrants arrive in the United States. This time the Eastern European Ashkenazi Jews arrive. They come to Newport. They see that there's already a synagogue here. So they get permission to reopen the doors. So from the late 1800s to today, been in continuous active use. So that's a very brief inversion of 500 years of history, and now I'll point out different things in here. Probably the most prized possession we have is behind this door here, this Torah scroll. This was a gift, the Torah being the first five books of the Bible, you know, handwritten on parchment. This was a gift from the great Portuguese synagogue in Amsterdam. They sent this over as a gift in 1763. This is written on deerskin. Deerskin has a natural oil in it that keeps it supple, that keeps it from drying out or cracking or breaking. So today, this Torah scroll is over 500 years old. It's one of the oldest Torah scrolls in the United States. And you can come up in a bit after I'm done and see the condition of this, because it is truly remarkable. You could read this clear as day today, as you probably would have been able to over 500 years ago. And it was used as the original scroll here, but not anymore, of course. The scrolls that are used today are kept behind these doors, the Ark. During services, the rabbi will, there's four scrolls in here, by the way. He'll take the scrolls from the Ark and he'll walk it over to the Bima, this raised platform here in the middle. And he'll conduct services from there where he is amongst the congregation. He faces east towards Jerusalem, as the Ark must also face east. That's why when you came up the hill this morning, you may have noticed that the synagogue sits at a very severe angle to the rest of the street, because when they were building it, they wanted to adhere to every tradition possible. It's also very important to point out where they built this in relation to the rest of the town. They built it up high on the hill above the harbor. Colonial days, you would have been able to see this from the waterfront. They built it amongst all these other houses of worship and religions in the neighborhood. And if you look out any side, they built it with these big, beautiful windows. Hi. Anyone walking by here would have been able to see. Actually, I'm sorry, I can't have you sitting on the beam. I'm sorry, I just saw you there. Anyone walking by would have been able to look inside these windows and see the congregation in here worshiping freely. Something that was not very often seen, because if you look at synagogues built over in Europe during the same time period, a lot of times they are in alleyways, or they're behind buildings, or they have tiny little windows so as not to draw attention. So this really shows, you know, the fact that they built it in such a prominent location, in such plain sight, really shows that level of comfort and acceptance that they felt here. Like I said, all the brass is original. Many of it gifts from either local families or from other congregations. The Ner Tamid, the eternal light right above my head, signifies God's presence in the sanctuary at all times. It was a gift from a member of Congregation Sherith Israel in New York who sent it over. Five chandeliers hang overhead, also from local families and congregations. If you turn around and see, there's an old wooden clock. It's up at 12 o'clock right now. That's because it's over 300 years old. It's kind of hard to find somebody who knows how to wind 300-year-old clocks. That wooden clock, as well as two wooden charity boxes that are on the front two columns, the Dhaka boxes, those were from the Bevis Marks congregation in London. They sent those over as gifts. excuse me. Like I said, all the wood is original. The original wooden floors are underneath all this carpeting. The chairs you're sitting on are not original. Those were added in the 1950s for extra seating. Originally, the only seating in the entire synagogue was this kind of wainscoting bench that goes along the whole outer perimeter. That cushion obviously would not have been there. This is an Orthodox synagogue. It always has been. It always will be. So men and women sit separately during services. Men are down here on the first floor. Women are upstairs on the second floor. There are no stairs in here, if you take another quick look around. So to get upstairs, you may have noticed when you walked up the hill, there's another building attached over on that, beyond that wall there. It's original as well. The first floor has a one-room
Hebrew day school for students in colonial days. Second floor has a little office room for the rabbi, so it's in that building that has a separate entrance staircase for women to enter and exit up there. This large chandelier overhead contains 12 offshoots representing the 12 tribes of Israel. Okay? There are also 12 of these columns on the first and second floor that go around, representing the 12 tribes as well. Each one of these columns is carved from single tree trunks that were on the property here at the time that the synagogue was being built, oak trees. The color in here is not quite original. Originally, this would have been a dark kind of reddish stain on all this wood. It would have been much darker in here. They peeled away 18 layers of paint off the interior here in a renovation they did 5 years ago. And we find this color, this colonial green. This is what the synagogue would have looked like in 1790. 1790 is a very important year to the synagogue, and I'll get back to it in one moment. Against this wall here, you kind of see right behind these guys, is this raised bench. We call it the presidential pew. It's where the president of the congregation sits during services, special visitors. Three presidents of the United States have sat there on visits to Newport. President Kennedy, President Eisenhower, and George Washington. George Washington sat there in 1790, kind of on a promotional tour, if you will, with Thomas Jefferson of the with the Bill of Rights. In 1790, the Constitution had just been ratified. Rhode Island was the final signers of that, narrowly passed here, but we were the first signers of the Bill of Rights. So Washington came here and he exchanged letters with Moses Satius, who was the president of the congregation at that time period. Satius had written to Washington, you know, saying essentially, thank you for this opportunity to work and worship freely in this new country, but also his hesitancy, you know, was it going to stay this way? He pointed out every time there was a change in government, as history had shown, Jews had to leave or convert. Washington responded in a brief 340-word letter that he addressed to the Hebrew congregation in Newport, a letter that has really gone on to become a defining symbol of religious freedom here. He said, "It is now no more that toleration is merely spoken of, as if it was by the indulgence of one group that another enjoys the exercise of its inherent natural rights. So happily, the government of the United States gives to bigotry no sanction and to persecution no assistance." What he said in that letter was that America is different. You know, where once religious minorities were only tolerated, here in this new country, toleration isn't enough. Because if you think about it, toleration isn't always a good thing. That's something that can be taken away from one day to the next by somebody who holds more power. So he explained that in this new country, every person is given that freedom of religion at the moment of birth, and it's protected under this new law here, something that can't be taken away from you. So, you know, maybe something we don't think twice about today or take for granted, but at that time period, that was a truly revolutionary concept and one that would hopefully set the standard and become the ideal. So the fact that it was addressed here to the congregation here is very important to us, and it's something we celebrate every August here as well in the reading of those letters. And it's just really neat to think that this is exactly how Washington would have seen that, you know, seen the inside here of the synagogue in 1790. What time is it? Okay, I've got a couple more minutes. There's one more thing I want to show you on the bima. Now, this is a huge group, so you can look from it from both sides. And unfortunately, I can't let you up on the bima. But I want you to take a look at a special feature we have here. If you look right in the center of our bima, we have a trap door here. It's original to the synagogue. It was in the plan for Peter Harrison to install. It's you lift it up, lift the door up, drop it about 8 feet deep into our half dirt floor basement type room. Apparently, there are synagogues over in Europe that have similar trap doors that over there were used as a means of escape in case Jews there needed to flee from their synagogue at a moment's notice, you know, for fear of persecution. So people have come here for years, seeing that Toro Synagogue also has a similar door. So this wild rumor was started. They have a trap door, they must also have a tunnel, because in Europe,
we would go through there, through the trapdoor, it would lead to tunnels that would lead to our safe. So people thought the same thing was here. The rumor was that it went under Marsh Street over there to one of those basements across the way. I'm sorry to disappoint you, but it's simply not true. There is no tunnel leaving Toro Synagogue. And we think the original congregation did that on purpose. We think they put this door in here kind of as a symbol, you know, to remember those generations and those ancestors that had to endure that fear. So kind of as a reminder, but purposefully without a tunnel leading out, because they didn't need a tunnel here in Newport. You know, like I said before, you look out any of these windows and see where we are. We're in the heart of downtown Newport amongst all these other houses of worship and all these other religions that we're welcoming. So as a reminder, to remember those times they put the door, but they were finally in a place where they didn't need to run away from. They were finally safe.
On a cold and windy day almost 200 years ago, a man named Meyer Moses stood up at a meeting and declared, "Collect together thy long scattered people, and let their gathering place be in this land of milk and honey." He was referring to a land where Jews were offered dignity and equality. The year was 1806. That land was the United States of America. Over 350 years ago, Jews from locations as diverse as Europe, the Caribbean, and Brazil came to North America in search of economic opportunity, freedom, and in many cases, a new beginning. In honor of this 350-year anniversary, the Jewish Theological Seminary Choir practiced some of the melodies of the time that were performed at a colonial-era Shabbat service.
Jewish life in the New World begins as part of a great wave, which is a Jewish migration from the East to the West. It was part of the age of colonialization, the penetration of Europe, of the New World, and Jews were part of that movement that dispersed human population.
Over the next 170 years, Jews developed a significant presence in six American colonies in North America.
The colonies of Jews that existed in North America on the eve of the American Revolution shared a number of characteristics. First, with the exception of Richmond, which was really the latest of the six original Jewish congregations, all Atlantic ports. So these were people from the wealthiest to the poorest who had some connection to trade. And they had an important place in those colonies and in those cities by virtue of their relationships to transatlantic or para-Atlantic trade. Jews in each one of the colonies had networks among themselves. A great deal linked them. They had relationships. They shared family. They shared all sorts of institutions. But they didn't necessarily see a difference between themselves and Jews in the West Indies. They all maintained relationships back with Amsterdam and London. So there really was this Jewish world, that the Atlantic served as the kind of Jewish sea linking the Jews in all of these colonies.
In the 1600s, Jews had settled in the New World in, among other places, the Dutch colony of Recife in Brazil. There, Jews, as was common in Amsterdam, lived in relative equality, allowed to practice their religion openly.
The reason that New Amsterdam is first is that Jews were forced to leave Recife in Brazil, which had been a Dutch colony where large numbers of Jews actually had settled when the Dutch conquered it from the Portuguese in 1630, and they're forced to leave in 1654 when the Portuguese conquer it back from the Dutch, bring with it the Inquisition. Basically, the Jews, and it's often forgotten, the Protestants, are given 3 months to leave. Like sensible people, they took the hint.
Some of them returned to Amsterdam, but 23 of them boarded the St. Catherine and sailed to New Amsterdam.
They went there because it was Dutch, and indeed, when they seek permission to settle, they say, listen, we supported you in the battle at Recife. We've been very good citizens. We shed blood on your behalf. You owe it to us.
When the Jews arrived in 1654 in New Amsterdam, they found a very hostile authority to greet them, namely the governor of the place, Peter Stuyvesant, who was the governor of all of New Netherland, which stretched from places in New Jersey all the way up to Albany, New York. But Stuyvesant also opposed Christians who were not members of the Calvinist branch of Protestantism. What he evidently envisioned was a kind of uniform population and social system within New Netherland. He even took steps against Lutherans and Quakers and Mennonites, but certainly as well against the Jews.
He wrote to the directors of the Dutch West India Company to give him permission to expel the Jews. But the tiny Jewish population also had well-situated connections in the company.
And over the objections of Governor Peter Stuyvesant, the Dutch West India Company, among whose shareholders were not a few Jews, the Dutch West India Company orders him to allow the Jews to remain.
By and large, they were coming to America for the lure of economic opportunity. And in a way, I think that the economic basis of the migration in some ways makes a much more exciting story and makes them much more real people for us as we try to understand who they were and what they did. These weren't people without options. For example, the first group that come to New Amsterdam, they had the option of going back to Amsterdam. But the colonies in North America were a place where somebody could get in on the ground floor. There were vast stretches of land for fur and for other resources. Interestingly, they become assertive about their political rights. When they sue for the right to stand with the militia, to the watch to guard the city, they're saying, we are part of this community.
In 1655, Asher Levy sought to enlist in the militia. He was refused, and instead, along with other Jews, was ordered to pay a tax because of their exemption. Declining to pay, he petitioned for the right to stand guard, which he was ultimately granted. He was one of the first Jews to own land in what are now known as Albany and New York City.
I think what's very interesting where they don't demand rights is in the realm of religion, because the impositions that had been imposed upon them were in some ways very artificial and didn't reflect the needs for the practice of Judaism. So in New Amsterdam, where the authorities said that they couldn't have a synagogue, the Jews didn't care because they didn't need it. They could worship privately, and that was just as good as having a public house of worship. They did ask for the right to have a cemetery, which really was much more fundamental to the practice of Judaism than having a public building marked synagogue.
In 1655, there were at least 13 male Jews in New Amsterdam, and they petitioned for a plot of land for a cemetery, one of the first steps for a congregation about to embark on communal institutions.
In 1656, we have reference to the fact that they bought land for a cemetery. We don't know exactly where that land is, but the oldest cemetery that we have down on Chatham Square, the earliest stone dates back to 1683.
Chatham Square is the congregation's second cemetery.
The synagogues served as a central address for Jewish life in the colonial and early national periods.
That meant that they provided for the goods and services needed by individual Jews. The most important was a cemetery plot. The synagogues controlled the Jewish cemetery plots. And if one was not a member in good standing of the synagogue, one would not be buried in the Jewish cemetery, which was a lever that the community had with the families of individuals who passed away.
Shortly after the English took over the colony in 1664, Jews were eventually allowed to worship in public.
The challenge that was faced by Jews when they arrived was how they were going to create vibrant Jewish communities in a setting that functioned on the basis of voluntarism. They had to voluntarily band together to create institutions to benefit themselves and also for worship. And they found a method to introduce compulsion into Jewish life via the synagogues.
During the 75 years between the arrival of Jews in New Amsterdam and the building of the first permanent synagogue structure in the New World, Jews worshipped in homes and followed the ritual observances such as circumcision, koshering meat, matzah for Passover, all the time balancing their religious and secular lives.
This community worships in probably private homes at first, rented homes later on. And then in 1728, they began to build a synagogue, and in 1730, they dedicated their first building structure, the Mill Street Synagogue, and we can actually see that. It appears on the map.
And that was the first synagogue building built in North America. If you look at our small synagogue, you'll see it's fairly small. The first building was 50 feet by 50 feet square, and that was able to house all of the Jews of New York City. So maybe we're talking about 100, 150 people or so.
Although the Mill Street Synagogue no longer exists, some of its furnishings are housed at the Little Synagogue of Sherith Israel.
We use a little synagogue for daily services, and it's a visible reminder of our connection with the colonial Jewish experience in New York.
It's conventional to refer to the early periods of American Jewish history as the Sephardic era. But in fact, already in the early 1700s, the majority of the Jews living in North America were of Ashkenazic background. Nonetheless, the Sephardim dominated the Jewish community. They were the leaders of the community, and their synagogue rituals dominated the way in which all the synagogues operated during the colonial and even the early national periods of American Jewish history.
Many years ago, when I began serving as a student rabbi, then assistant rabbi of this congregation, I spent my days reading the early archives of the congregation, including the minute books that go back to colonial days. And I was amazingly impressed by the fact that on the top of many pages, it would say in beautiful handwriting, "In the name of Almighty God, the Lord of Israel, Amen," or some similar phrase. They call themselves Sherith Israel, the remnant of Israel, because they saw themselves as a little group of Jewish people in a faraway, remote area, and they saw themselves as being very faithful to the traditions of the Jewish people. At the same time, they recognized that they were, in some way, distinctively modern Jews. They weren't coming out of ghettos. They were the first Jews in modern times who had real sense of their own dignity and freedom. They felt the right to participate in society. They demanded the right to participate in society at large.
Abigail Franks and her husband, Jacob Franks, were leaders of New York's tiny Jewish community. She confronted head-on the struggle of maintaining a religious life alongside a secular one in her desire for her children to marry only in the Jewish faith.
Abigail Franks, who was the great letter writer of colonial Jewry, who told her son Naftali when he went to England that he should never eat anything in his uncle's house because she didn't trust his kashrut. She gives us such a wonderful portrait of that colonial world. Her spirit was utterly crushed when her daughter Fila married outside of the faith, married Oliver Delancey, so we learned something about the struggles of that community with intermarriage.
Yet at the same time, Abigail Franks wanted to read English literature, to have non-Jewish friends, and she did, and be part of the larger society.
The small number of Jewish colonists caused some to abstain from marriage or intermarry.
When we study a period that we think is so distant from our lives today, we learn that actually the Jews then faced so many of the same challenges that we face today. Challenges of intermarriage, challenges of survival in a free society. And we can gain insight by looking at what they were struggling with then. We can also take comfort to know that we Jews have survived and are thriving here today.
One leader of Sherith Israel was integral to the survival of the community.
In 1768, the congregation employed Reverend Gershel Mendestatius to be its chazan, or religious leader. Gershel Mendestatius was actually born in New York and was trained in the synagogue school. He led the congregation for a period spanning 50 years, including the period of the American Revolution. A very intelligent person. We have some of his sermons. He was active in all phases of city life as well as Jewish life, and he represented the Jewish community to the non-Jewish community outside.
Because the synagogues had controlled all resources, therefore it put a great deal of power in the hands of the tight little clique of the Parnassim, the wealthy merchants who ran the congregations, and they attempted to control people's lives. Certainly, I think by contemporary standards, we'd say that they really meddled on a kind of micro level, trying to find out if Hetty Hayes's boarding house was in fact serving food that was not kosher. The delegation went to visit and look in her pots.
Synagogue life in Europe as well as in colonial America was largely governed by the well-to-do. Rabbis played a significant role in this process in the European context because there they served as judges and adjudicators of Jewish law, and even more important, as the administrators of the Jewish community. In the American framework, rabbis only arrived well into the 1830s, and as a result of that, the lives of the synagogues revolved around the activities of lay leaders of the communities. And these lay leaders also tried to exercise control over the membership by passing regulations, by requiring Jews to pay fines if they acted out, if they misbehaved. But there were many Jews who simply did not pay those fines.
One of the founding families of New York's Jewish community was the Nathans, of which Edgar Nathan is a descendant.
Before the Revolution, the first Nathan came, a man named Simon Nathan. He was a merchant, came to this country. He married Gershom Mendestatius' sister and became an integral and important part of New York and American life. He enlisted in the militia during the Revolution. He was a man of some substance. He financed a good part of the Revolution, certainly for one individual or family, so much so that he was in severe financial straits. Nobody was able to repay him.
As the New York Jewish community developed, it had the desire to extend its horizons.
One of the earliest demands of the Jewish settlers in New Amsterdam was for the right of trade beyond the city itself and to have access to the immense riches of the Hudson River Valley, the furs, the timber. all the access to the Indian trade. That was really where the money was to be made, and they didn't want to be cut out of that, so they were very assertive about their economic rights.
In the early 1700s, Luis Gomez petitioned and was awarded denization papers, the rights to trade and own land.
The Gomez Mill House in upstate New York is one of the oldest physical artifacts that we have of the early American Jewish presence. It's probably the second oldest, only exceeded in age by the cemetery in New York City that belongs to the Sheirith Israel congregation. One of the leading members of Sheirith Israel in the late 1600s and early 1700s, an individual who had left Spain, no doubt because of inquisitional problems, was Luis Gomez. He and his many sons established what was the leading Sephardic Jewish family in New York City. And to make their livings, the Gomezes traded extensively across the length and breadth of the Atlantic Ocean. And in order to supply that larger world one of the most desirable commodities of the time, namely furs, they established a trading post right near the Hudson River. Members of the family probably lived there, not permanently, but from time to time during trading season, and would bring manufactured goods, which they imported from Europe, foodstuffs like sugar, up the Hudson River to their outpost there, and exchange these commodities for the furs that the Indians brought to the trading post. The furs would then be brought down the Hudson and shipped abroad, where they would be manufactured into such desirable things as beaver hats, which were all the rage in Europe at the time.
One of the things that was so attractive for Jews in their lives here in this country is how free they felt, particularly economically, that there were few restrictions on the fields in which they could make a good living. And when they compared that to the various restrictions on their economic life in Europe, they felt blessed. But of course, they were plagued with the same problems that we're plagued with here, that with freedom goes also the freedom to forget one's Jewish life.
I think we were talking about a time where the community was very small, and if people wanted to identify as Jews, the only place they could identify as Jews was in the synagogue in Sheirith Israel in New York. The amazing thing is that the congregation was able to maintain itself as a cohesive, consistent organization that was able to go from generation to generation in the last 350 years, which is really a remarkable story.
In 1658, not long after Jews arrived in New Amsterdam, a group of 15 families, Jews probably from the island of Barbados, and looking for a New England port town, were attracted to Roger Williams' Rhode Island and his renown for religious freedom.
Newport has several beginnings. You have records of Jews in the 17th century. But Newport as a Jewish community gets going when Newport itself takes off. It becomes an important port. It's a free port. Trade increases, and Jews move in the 1740s, 1750s. Several of them are related to one another, some of them coming direct from the Iberian Peninsula, where they had lived underground for several hundred years, since 1492. They come to Newport, they come out of the closet, so to speak, as Jews, and some of them, Vieira, Lopez, they are very successful, and that, of course, brings other Jews, so that something on the order of 10% of the significant merchants of Newport are Jewish.
For a long, long time, the community was following the Sephardic or Spanish ritual, and to this day, we still have that in our synagogue. They were thrilled beyond belief to be able to practice Judaism publicly, but for them, that meant they could pray in each other's homes. That did not enable them to build a synagogue because they couldn't afford it.
By the middle of the 18th century, approximately 25 families lived in Newport, including Moses Levy, Isaac Hart, and Aaron Lopez, a refugee from the Inquisition and probably one of the most successful merchants and shipowners of the time.
He had been living in Portugal, outwardly as Catholic and privately as Jewish, he and his wife bolted, came to Newport for the first time, had a circumcision performed as an adult, remarried his wife in a Jewish ceremony because the first time it was in a church ceremony.
One of the most exciting episodes and unusual in all of colonial history is Aaron Lopez sending a ship with secret instructions to ferret his half-brother out of Portugal, bring him to Newport, where he comes, returns to Judaism, takes on a new name, and is kind of born again. Again, remember, this is 300 years after Jews have been expelled. And it's also clear that Lopez is keeping tabs on his relatives who are living underground as Jews. So it's really extraordinary.
Lopez made his fortune trading sperm whale oil used for making candles, but he also dealt with slaves.
Aaron Lopez does deal somewhat in slaves as part of his trading activity. You have some Jews who own slaves. It's not very significant in terms of numbers. The history of slavery in this country would be identical if no Jew had come to America and if no Jew had been involved. I think the bottom line is really Jews were not very different from their neighbors when it came to slavery. You had some Jews in New York who were deeply unhappy about slavery, and you have some Jews who clearly had a blind spot. They are like their neighbors in this regard, for better and for worse.
In 1759, the Jews of Newport began work on their synagogue, which was dedicated in 1763.
They built that very beautiful little synagogue, which we know as the Touro Synagogue today. It wasn't its original name, but there you had a community that had really prospered, and this was the demonstration of their newfound prosperity.
Tradition says that it is the fear of the Inquisition that was the cause of what appears to be an escape trap door, though there is no evidence. It may just have been an easy way to get to the basement. Unfortunately, the Jewish community of Newport did not recover from the Revolutionary War, since the colony was occupied by the British and its pier was used for firewood. Most of the families had fled. Their naval routes were lost to other ports. Yet the deed to the synagogue stayed in the hands of their sister synagogue, Sherith Israel in New York, securing its future. Much further south, a Jewish presence was also taking root. The colony of Charleston, established in 1670, began seeing Jewish settlers by 1695, drawn in large part to the civil and religious liberty afforded by South Carolina and the economic opportunities available.
After New Amsterdam and Newport, we also find Jews appearing in Charleston in the 1690s and early 1700s. They came, they went, they were always few in number, but there does seem to have been something of a presence that continued from time to time, because very curiously, Jews are spoken of as having voted in an election in Charleston in 1703. Very, very unusual for the times to find Jews participating in public activities, having the right to vote.
The early arrivals for Sephardic Jews came from London, and we can go back as far as 1697 when the governor made 64 settlers, citizens of the province of Carolina, which extended from Virginia to the coast of Florida, and four were Jews, and we have their names.
Jews were attracted to the port of Charlestown because it was a mercantile center. It was one of the most important commercial centers on the coast of the then colonies. Jews tended to be involved in merchant pursuits, tradesmen, brokers, auctioneers, this sort of thing. So it was a place where they knew they could make a living and they knew they could practice their faith without interference.
By 1749, there were sufficient numbers to organize Kahal Kadosh Beth Elohim, Holy Congregation House of God, KKBE. And 15 years later, the Cumming Street Cemetery, the oldest remaining Jewish burial ground in the South.
The cemetery was a family cemetery started by Isaac da Costa. He bought the land on which the cemetery is located back to 1762. It was listed in some of the documents as a Jews' cemetery. Da Costa sold the cemetery to the congregation in 1764. That's when it became a congregational cemetery. One of the stipulations was that it would be open to all Jews in South Carolina who abided by the Jewish faith. The oldest grave we've identified in the cemetery is of Moses Cohen. Moses Cohen was a religious leader of the congregation when it was founded in 1749. He was the Chazan.
The cemetery also includes some of Charleston's leading Jewish families of the time, including the Minas and the Moyes family, of which Anita Moyes Rosefield Rosenberg is a descendant.
We are very careful to pass along any history, any items, jewelry of the women, desk things that the men may have had, letter openers, things like that. We pass them along from generation to generation. We want the children who grow up in the family to have a sense of history about our family and its place in the South. This is a beautiful gold bracelet that was a wedding present to Esther Lyon Moyes in the 1800s. We know that she wore it. Her initials are engraved on the inside of it. So it is with great pride that my mother passed it on to me. Over the years, my mother collected the thimbles of the ladies in the family. They gave a girl a beautiful gold thimble, usually with her initials carved into it, so that she could learn to sew as Southern ladies did. And mother had all of these wonderful thimbles put on a bracelet so that when we wear these thimbles, we remember all the ladies in our family who came before us. We remember them because there's nothing more important than a Jewish family. And if you're going to pass that on from generation to generation, the children in the family have to know the history.
Some early settlers looked for a more complete connection to organized faith.
One of my favorite characters from that period is a woman by the name of Rebecca Samuel, who wrote a letter to her parents back in Germany. She wrote to them in Yiddish to reassure them that even though she was living in Virginia, that she would maintain Jewish life in raising her own two young children. That she was in fact moving to Charleston, because in Charleston there was a critical mass of Jews.
This is at the end of the 18th century. It's a very powerful statement of what people thought they needed. They needed a minyan. They needed a critical mass to have kosher, a shachet, someone to produce kosher meat, to have a Sabbath service, etc.
In 1794, KKBE built their synagogue. It was destroyed by fire and subsequently rebuilt in 1840, one of the oldest synagogues in the United States. A bit further south, a Jewish community was also beginning in Georgia.
The first Jews who came to Savannah came on July 11th of 1733. It was the largest landing of Jews during the colonial period. They came from London, England. They were sponsored by the Bevis Marks congregation, which is the oldest Jewish congregation in Great Britain. And actually, it was different from all the other landings in that they came with a Torah, came with the ability of having services. They had more than enough for a minyan, for prayer,
And while they didn't officially establish the congregation until 2 years later and give it its name, Mikveh Israel, they really were a congregation from the very first day that they landed, in that they had a wonderful Torah scroll with them. We still have that Torah scroll in our museum.
When James Oglethorpe opens up Savannah and declares that it is really going to be a place of refuge, then the Jewish community in London sends a ship with Jews who couldn't really earn a living. They were new in London. This was a way of getting rid of people who you were supporting. But there were people who they thought could succeed, and some of them were doctors and so on. James Oglethorpe never in his wildest dreams imagined that he was going to get Jews. He thought, you know, just different branches of Protestants. But fortunately for the Jews, they come at the time of a plague. There is a doctor on board. He's credited with ending the plague. They admit the Jewish community. They don't last very long because the Spaniards are threatening to make war on Georgia. Every Jew of Spanish and Portuguese extraction knew that if Spain won that war, the Inquisition would come and they would be in serious trouble. So within 8 years, only the two Ashkenazim remain and everybody else moves away.
The Scheftel and Minas families from Germanic backgrounds stayed. And in 1774, with four other Jewish families, they endeavored to function as a congregation. Marion Mendel is a descendant of the Scheftel family.
Mordechai Scheftel was a merchant. He was a tanner. He was a landowner. He acquired a lot of real estate. And he had amassed quite a bit of money. He was worth a lot. When the colonists first came over, they held services in each other's homes, which of course at that time were huts, tents. In the minutes are mentioned the fact that the services were held in Mordechai Scheftel's home. It was through his efforts that they probably built the first synagogue in Georgia, and he gave the land that had been deeded to him for the purpose of establishing a cemetery for all Jews.
They began operating under the name Kahal Kodosh Mikveh Israel.
The Jewish community in Savannah, I think, represented really the ebb and flow of the fortunes of Savannah. When things are doing well here, the Jewish community would grow, and when things were not doing well, it would somewhat diminish. It wasn't really until after the revolution and the establishment of the United States that the community was totally and completely entrenched and secure.
Mordechai Scheftel became the highest-ranking Jewish officer of the American Revolutionary Forces and was taken prisoner along with his son, Scheftel Scheftel.
This chair figures in this sketch here of Scheftel Scheftel, and he's wearing the costume of a revolutionary soldier and a cocked hat. And we have the cocked hat that came down through all these years. He was the last person to discard the wearing of the colonial soldier. And for that reason, he was known as Cocked Hat. I have Mordechai Scheftel's shoe buckles, his toddy cup. He was a very observant Jew, and he kept kosher. And when he went out into the countryside, he wanted to be sure that the eating utensils that he used were kosher, and he carried his little scout kit with him. I feel that I'm very fortunate because I have lots and lots of old documents and papers that are of historical import. We're fortunate that they had enough of a feeling for history that they kept them safe.
After the war, in 1790, Congregation Mikveh Israel was incorporated under the Scheftel leadership. Their first synagogue structure was destroyed by fire in 1829. Their present synagogue was consecrated in 1878. Philadelphia, like the other major colonies, was attractive as a port and drew permanent Jewish settlers in 1737.
In the same period of time when something was being tried in Savannah, there was also the development of a small Jewish presence in Philadelphia. A few Jews came from New York City down to Philadelphia in 1737, 1738, and evidently they were intent on staying because in the early 1740s they acquired land for a cemetery.
Nathan Levy had a daughter and had to be buried, so he wanted to be buried in a Jewish cemetery, and therefore he bought the plot, which still exists now, and exists on 8th Street and Spruce.
Shortly after, the Franks brothers, David and Moses, joined the Levies, beginning the nucleus of the Philadelphia Jewish community. David Franks launched the career of Bernard Gratz, who along with his brother Michael provided leadership for the 100-strong, committed Jewish men and women found in Philadelphia on the eve of the Revolution.
The thing about the Philadelphia Jewish community is that it has this remarkable group of women. Rebecca Machado Phillips bore 21 children, but she also was a sustainer of her synagogue, and she left a legacy to the synagogue, and she was involved in business activities as well. She gives us a full portrait of what women's lives were like in that era, if we can imagine a life spent so much in childbearing and child-rearing. She and Grace Nathan raised money to buy the ritual objects for the synagogue.
The congregation still retains the Torah crowns, created by the premier Jewish silver artisan of the time, Meyer Myers. During the Revolutionary War, Philadelphia became the safe haven for many of the Jewish colonists who had pledged their alliance to the American side, including Gershom Mendesatius, who fled New York with his congregation and their Torahs. This enabled the colony's original Jewish population to construct a permanent synagogue, aided by donations from Jews and non-Jews alike, including £5 from Benjamin Franklin. Perhaps due to a combination of factors, the relatively inhospitable religious climate, the agrarian economy when Jews were primarily merchants, and the lack of a major urban center, Richmond was the last of the original six Jewish congregations. It began to develop as Virginia itself opened up economically and began to flourish.
In 1784, 1785, Virginia ended religious qualifications as a requirement for voting or for service in office. And therefore Jews became emancipated as well in Virginia. And this may help explain why Richmond suddenly began to be a place where Jews would head for and settle and a new Jewish community develop.
Although there were Jewish settlers like Isaiah Isaacs and Jacob Cohen as early as 1769, only after the War of Independence and Virginia's Act for Religious Freedom, originally drafted by Thomas Jefferson in 1779, did the community get underway. This stated that all men shall be free to profess and by argument to maintain their opinions in matters of religion, and that the same shall in no wise diminish, enlarge, or affect their civil capacities.
And in 1789, they established the first congregation in the colony of Virginia, which was Beth Shalom Congregation, right here in Richmond.
Claire Milheiser Rosenbaum is a descendant of the Levies and Ezekiels, two early Jewish Richmond families.
There were 29 adult males who signed the article of bylaws to establish the congregation, and we can only assume that there were women and children, but they are not included in the census or in the signing of the bylaws of the congregation.
In 1791, the dedication of the first Jewish cemetery in Virginia took place at the Franklin Street Burial Ground, donated by Isaiah Isaacs, and where Richmond's earliest Jews are buried. The War of Independence marked a turning point of sorts for Jews, primarily in the area of political freedom.
First of all, the Jews themselves took a very bold step during the revolution, and they decided to take sides, to actually participate. This is, as far as I know, the first time in modern history anywhere that Jews took a political position, became part of the political fabric. They didn't have to do this. There was no pressure on them to choose sides. A great many of them, though, chose the American side. A small number of them chose the British side. They felt comfortable enough and secure enough to be able to openly embrace and support and be part of a political position. Now, thanks to that, after the revolution, Jews pointed to their service, particularly on the American side, in advancing the case for political equality.
One of those was Francis Salvador, who served in the South Carolina Assembly at the age of 27. He was the first Jew to die in the Revolutionary War at the age of 29.
A vigorous, idealistic young man who comes to South Carolina, who's a planter, owns a whole bunch of land somewhere in South Carolina, who's the first Jew in the New World, really the first Jew in the world, elected to a popular assembly. And then he enlists in the Revolutionary Army, and he's killed in the service of his country.
Their military service helped their claim for political parity.
They pointed to the fact that they had devoted themselves and their personal possessions, their wealth, such as it was, to the American side. And thus they made the claim that we participated in support of the American Revolution, and shouldn't there be acknowledgement of that by inclusion in the body politic?
So it is no surprise the joy that the Jews felt with the Federal Constitution in 1787 and the Bill of Rights in 1791, which outlawed religious tests as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States, and forbade Congress from making any law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. A gala parade marking the ratification of the Constitution was held in Philadelphia on July 4, 1788, and members of Christian denominations, as well as the Jewish community, walked arm in arm, evidence of the equality of all religions in the young country. The six Jewish congregations were also pleased by the election of George Washington as president of the young nation, and wound up writing letters of congratulations. The first from Savannah, the second from Newport, and the third from the other four congregations.
What's so interesting is how, at the earliest opportunity, these communities want to express their individualism so that right after the American Revolution, there is not a single letter to George Washington from the Jewish community, you know, all uniting under New York. On the contrary, he gets three different letters from different communities, and the correspondence makes clear that is no accident. They want to express the fact that just as each colony was different and each state is different and each Protestant church is different, so each synagogue is going to be different, and that congregational model becomes important.
Moses Satius wrote the letter from the Newport congregation. Deprived as we heretofore have been of the invaluable rights of free citizens, we now, with a deep sense of gratitude to the almighty disposer of all events, behold a government erected by the majesty of the people, a government which to bigotry gives no sanction, persecution. And Washington responded.
We have the very bold step taken by George Washington in 1790 in his well-known letter to the Jewish community of Newport. Washington spoke of the Jews as being citizens, as being members of the body politic. And this was the first time anywhere in Western society in the modern era in which the head of a state
reached out to and embraced the Jewish population as equal members of the society. This had to have a very powerful impact because, after all, this was George Washington, literally the father of the country.
Newport commemorates this event by reading Washington's letter in an annual ceremony at Touro Synagogue.
Distinguished citizens of this wonderful community and congregation, it is my privilege to read President George Washington's response, in which the President set the standard for religious freedom and civil liberties in America. To the Hebrew congregation in Newport, Rhode Island, gentlemen, while I receive with much satisfaction your address replete with expressions of affection and esteem, I rejoice in the opportunity. For happily, the government of the United States, which gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance, requires only that they who live under its protection should demean themselves as good citizens in giving it on all occasions their effectual support. It would be inconsistent. May the children of the stock of Abraham who dwell in this land continue to merit and enjoy the goodwill of the other inhabitants, while everyone shall sit in safety under his own vine and fig tree, and there shall be none to make him afraid. May the Father of all mercies scatter.
The commitment the colonists had shown in the pre-revolutionary and revolutionary periods to fulfill their political, military, and social responsibilities and becoming more fully integrated in their young country showed concrete results in the early national period. Communities such as Charleston were strengthened economically.
From 1790, in other words, after the Revolution, until 1820, Charleston has the largest Jewish population in the United States, larger than New York City, larger than Philadelphia. And the reason for that, I think, is the same reason that it was true in the colonial period. I think that it had a flourishing economy, its connection to the Caribbean, its economic opportunity.
A Jewish communal infrastructure continued to openly develop.
The first benevolent society in America was founded by members of this congregation in 1784. It took care of indigents and also new immigrants and was like a burial society. It's called the Hebrew Benevolent Society, still in existence. The other organization is the Hebrew Orphan Society, founded in 1801, the oldest orphan society in America. They had a home for orphans and widows here and was also a school building for the students.
The Jewish community had reached a point that they could produce important leaders.
Mordecai Emanuel Noah is really the first person we can talk about who is truly a leader in the general community, a political leader. One time he's head of Tammany Hall. That is a very important newspaper editor in New York. And at the same time, he is the best known Jew of his day, someone who has been active in Jewish affairs as a lay leader. He is really someone who lives in two worlds and is interested in the relationship between these worlds. He's courageously standing up for Jewish rights, and when he himself feels that he's been the victim of anti-Semitism, he says, "This is America, I can fight for my rights," and yet at the same time, he is deeply involved in American politics. He insists that the fact that he's a Jew should not prevent him from holding office. And really the first person we know who succeeds in both realms.
Rebecca Gratz's work helped define a new identity for Jewish women.
She creates the first Jewish female organization outside of the synagogue in 1819, the Female Hebrew Benevolent Association. And why did she do it? She's part of a group of Philadelphia women, Jewish women and Christian women, who have been providing charity to the poor in Philadelphia, and she knows the Christians missionize when they go out, and she doesn't want them to missionize among the Jewish poor. So she's picking up on the charge that Stuyvesant was told when he was told the Jews can stay, but their poor shall not become a burden to the community. So she brackets it very nicely for the end of this period because she wants to take care of the Jewish poor.
I think that's the legacy they left us. Faithfulness to tradition, and at the same time, openness to society, openness to the world, participating in the world to the best of our ability, participating openly as Jews, as Americans, as people committed to the highest values that we represent.
Those Jews who went to Newport or Savannah or Charleston or Philadelphia were not so much unlike the people looking for new opportunities now. They went to places where there were no Jewish institutions waiting for them. There were no Jewish services that were ready to greet them and ask, what can we do for you? But rather, they had to create it for themselves. And the degree to which this was important to them, the degree to which they combined their risk-taking in the new world, moving into a place that was kind of unchartered, willing to build their own lives and the life of the community from the ground up in a piecemeal fashion is, I think, I find it a very stirring story.
Colonial Jews played a critical role in establishing themselves as a political group on the American scene. In contrast to Jews in many other places, these Jews began to assert their rights and ask for the possibility of participating in the political process.
Hallelujah, hallelujah, betzil shalei shabbat.
In subsequent centuries, American Jews followed in the path blazed by colonial American Jewry, and they discovered that America is a land of opportunity. And like colonial American Jews, they embraced those opportunities and participated in the adventure that is America.
The challenges that Jews faced 350 years ago are so similar to the challenges that we face today. Jews have, in a sense, never been more successful in this country. We've never been more integrated. We've never felt more comfortable as Americans. But with that comfort and ease and success comes the challenge of how to maintain ourselves as a vital Jewish community in the United States. How to be concerned with Jewish survival when, in a sense, we don't need to be concerned about anything. And that really is our challenge as we move forward for the next 350 years.
Hello, I'm Kevin Costner. Welcome back to 500 Nations. Even before the colonies were established in the East, the European entrepreneurs of the New World started pushing west, testing the boundaries of this rich new land. What they discovered was the wealth of the Indian nations and the staggering abundance of their natural resources, the beautiful furs, the endless supply of deerskins. Indian people in turn saw that the goods the Europeans offered made life a lot easier. Metal axes, knives, copper kettles, and guns. And for a time, this simple arrangement worked. But very quickly, North America became an irresistible prize to the Europeans. They sent armies to fight for the control of the continent's resources, the way modern armies fight over oil. In this hour, we take you to the heartland, to a continent in turmoil. Welcome to Part 5 of 500 Nations, A Cauldron of War.
When the white man came here a stranger, he saw that the furs worn by our nations were valuable, and he showed to our ancestors many goods which he brought with him, and these were very tempting. The white man said, "Will you not sell the skins of your animals for the goods I bring?" Our ancestors replied, "We will buy your goods, and you will buy our furs." The whites proposed nothing more. Our ancestors acceded to nothing else. Potashah, Ojibwe.
In the 1600s, French and English fur traders made deep inroads into the North American continent, where interior Indian nations hunted beaver, mink, fox, and other fur-bearing animals. For northern Indian nations, trading with Europeans was merely an expansion of a seasonal round that had been repeated for centuries. Winter was the traditional time for villages to disperse into smaller groups to hunt and trap from winter camps. Spring was the season when they came back together and resumed village life. Hunters returned home with their winter's take of pelts and welcomed trade. At first, European traders conformed to this cycle, and the beautiful and exotic furs placed Indian traders in a strong bargaining position.
I heard my host, a Montagnier leader, say one day jokingly, "The beaver does everything perfectly well. It makes kettles, hatchets, swords, knives, bread. In short, it makes everything." He was making sport of us Europeans who have such a fondness for the skin of this animal. Nicolas Denis, fur trader.
Fur trade was becoming central to the European economy. From beaver came felt, and when the felt hat came into fashion in Europe, the North Atlantic trade took on global proportions.
It seemed like the European way of trading was to go out and try to outdo one another, who was going to have the most. And so our people were not like that with the other nations before the Europeans, but they soon caught on to be able to become wealthy that way.
Increasing demand and higher prices forced the fur trade to change, and along with it, the very structure of Indian nations. Many Indian people found it more lucrative to trade than to pursue old economic activities.
If you take a primitive tribe anywhere and present them with something that's going to make them live faster, have an easier life, they will take it. You know, the easy way. And by using the easy way, you're losing also your culture, because keeping your culture is not always easy.
Young men broke away from their traditional community roles to pursue commercial hunting in order to obtain goods that could only be gained through trade. Agricultural nations planted less. Fields lay fallow as pelts were used to purchase food from European traders. Ancient cultural and religious values came under attack, as the relationships between Indian people, the land, and animals changed through commercial hunting. Even European traders noted the transition.
Before, they killed animals only in proportion as they had need of them. They never made an accumulation of skins of moose, otter, beaver, or others, but only so far as they needed them for personal use.
Within decades, the animal populations of entire regions were completely exterminated.
In the past, there was none to barter with us that would have tempted us to waste our animals, as we did after the white people came on this island.
Nations who once traded in peace were forced into competition, even hostility, as hunters encroached upon the lands of others.
The times are exceedingly altered. The times have turned everything upside down, chiefly by the help of the white people. In times past, our forefathers lived in peace, love, and great harmony, and had everything in great plenty. But alas, it is not so now. All our fishing, hunting, and fowling is entirely gone. Harry Quadwaqueet, Monhegan.
Adherence to traditional values was further eroded by the greatest of all scourges that flowed from trade, alcohol. A British trader observed,
"They do not call it drinking unless they become drunk. Immediately after taking everything with which they can injure themselves from the houses, the women carry it into the woods, where they go to hide with all their children. After that, the men have a fine time, beating, injuring, and killing one another."
With each generation, alcohol cut deeper into the social fabric of Indian nations. In 1803 alone, 21,000 gallons of rum flowed into the interior.
We are meant to deliberate upon what? Upon no less a subject than whether we shall or shall not be a people. The tyrant is no native to our soil, but is the pernicious liquid which our pretended white friends artfully introduced and so plentifully pours among us. Creek Speaker.
Trade also brought a deadly killer that went unrecognized until the 20th century. Indian nations had long traditions in painting and paint making, and few pigments were as highly prized as red ochre. When European traders introduced brilliant red vermilion paint, it became widely used for facial and body decoration. But the paint was made from lead and mercury, hidden poisons that may have struck down thousands.
Such was the agreement made by my ancestors with the white man. They hunted for the white man, and before many years, the game grew scarce. And the benefits we derive from this agreement are these. Instead of using a stone to cut my wood, I used a sharp axe. Instead of being clothed in my own warm, ancient clothing, I used that which comes from across the big water. Instead of having plenty of food, I am always hungry. And instead of being sober, the Indians are drunk.
Along the South Atlantic coast, one small Indian nation would take their economic destiny into their own hands. In 1670, the English founded Charleston on land belonging to the Siwi, or islanders. Charleston emerged as the economic heart of the southern colonies, built on a thriving trade in deer hides with the Siwi and neighboring nations.
In the late 1600s, with the founding of Charleston, the whole economy revolved around the Indian trade. The men who lived along Goose Creek became the big traders who would go into the interior, trading with the Indians, trading all manner of manufactured goods and beads, but primarily to get deer skins, which were being used for all kinds of purposes.
The financial success of the Charleston traders did not extend to their Indian suppliers, who typically received only 5% of what buyers in England paid for their hides. The Siwi were determined to be treated fairly. An English observer reported,
"Seeing that the ships always came in at one place made them very confident that that way was the exact road to England. And seeing so many ships come thence, they believed it could not be far." John Lawson, Surveyor General.
The Siwi believed that by rowing to the distant point on the horizon where ships first appeared, they would be able to find their way to England. Once there, they could establish direct trade, eliminating the expensive middlemen. Preparations were secretly begun.
It was agreed upon immediately to make an addition of their fleet by building more canoes, and those to be of the best sort and biggest size, as fit for their intended discovery. Some Indians were employed about making the canoes, others to hunting, everyone to the post he was most fit for, all endeavors tending towards an able fleet and cargo for Europe. John Lawson, Surveyor General.
After months of preparation, the canoes were loaded with hides, pelts, and the most valuable possessions of the Siwi nation. All able-bodied men and women boarded the vessels and launched into the surf, leaving behind only the children, the sick, and the very old. The Siwi nation had become a flotilla. But as they entered open ocean, their fragile endeavor turned disastrous. A gale blew up. High seas engulfed the Siwi canoes. Those strong enough to survive were not the fortunate ones. They were rescued by a passing English slave ship, only to be delivered to the auction block in the West Indies. In an instant, the Siwi nation ceased to exist. Its people had become a commodity. They were not alone. Indian slaves, along with deer hides and rum, formed the basis of the southern colonial economy.
In Charleston, South Carolina, the slave trade really started with the selling of Indians, and everything that we see later with the African Americans who were sold there was going on in the 1600s and 1700s with the Indians. They would be brought into market, they would be put up on a block, they would be auctioned off.
Many Indian slaves were kept for the home economy in the South, or shipped to New England. Most were sent to Barbados, the Bahamas, Jamaica, and other Caribbean outposts to work the sugar plantations. Life in servitude was brutal and short, and as Indian slaves succumbed to violence, disease, and harsh working conditions, African slaves were imported to take their place.
Africans and Indians were basically being treated as animals. Even though the Catholic Church had recognized the humanity of the Indians, most of the conquerors who came over did not recognize them as human beings, and they treated them the same way they would wild horses or cows, by branding them, by chaining them, by making them march in long lines chained to one another, and then by selling them in an auction block. You could see an Indian being sold in an auction block the same way you could see cows or horses or a mule being sold.
As late as 1730, one quarter of the slaves in some southern colonies were still Indian people.
They took a part of my tribe and sold them to the Spaniards in Bermuda. But I would speak, and I could wish it might be like the voice of thunder. that it might be heard afar off even to the ends of the earth. He that will advocate slavery is worse than a beast. And he that will not set his face against its corrupt principles is a coward and not worthy of being numbered among men. William Avis, Pequot.
New Amsterdam was renamed New York in 1664 after the British took over the colony. New York and other British colonies, including Massachusetts, New Jersey, and Maryland, were societies with slaves. Of the original 13 colonies, Carolina was the first in which slavery was the center of economic production, making it the first slave society. Racial slavery was sanctioned by Carolina's 1669 Constitution.
The Carolina colony, which was originally South Carolina and North Carolina, founded about 1670. It's one of these gifts from Charles II to his friends. Here's a place to exploit, fellas. Go to it.
Many South Carolinian whites came initially from Barbados, where the British had established a giant sugar economy with some 50,000 Afro-Caribbean slaves. The plantation system was merely transplanted, like a kind of virus, from the Caribbean to the American coast.
The more slaves that you brought gave you more land. You got 50 acres of land for every person that you brought into the Carolina colony. And so slavery was encouraged from the outset here. And, of course, the key was to find the type of work that slaves could do to make the colony profitable.
As the enslaved cleared land, the planters searched for a way to exploit the Carolina Lowcountry. They tried growing cotton and indigo and raising livestock. The more they tried, the more they failed to find a lucrative cash crop. The enslaved were growing something they called a riser, or rice, for themselves. They had grown it for hundreds of years in West Africa.
Now, it's not knowledge that they hold to themselves. Once they have shown other people how to plant this crop, they've lost control of the knowledge. And an entire economy based on exploitation of Africans is in place within a generation. And the shipment of Africans to South Carolina skyrockets.
So many of the Africans who were enslaved during the 17th and 18th century were ex-soldiers. Some of them would be captured through wars or civil wars. And these victors would sell the captives off to the Europeans. This had the advantage from their point of view of reducing their numerical strength, especially the soldier population of the opponents.
Their march to the coast. Many of them had not been to the coast before. They had not seen the ocean. They see white people for the first time. Who are these people? There was this folklore about cannibalism. Lots of slaves who were brought to the coast really were so afraid that these people were going to eat them.
Some of the people owning South Carolina are also invested in the Royal Africa Company and the slave trade themselves. They're getting a profit at both ends out of this.
The major profit came from the human cargo of enslaved Africans. Slave trading had become the basis of an international economy.
There are a variety of auxiliary industries, that is shipbuilding, insuring those ships, making sales for those ships. So the expansion of slavery then is an essential part of the expansion of capitalism.
As the ships came from West Africa and people were dying, their bodies would be thrown overboard, usually in the middle of the Atlantic. But once in a while, the captains would wait until they arrived at Charleston Harbor. So one of these captains threw several dozen overboard. And their bodies, including children, began to wash ashore. So the governor became very upset. And it wasn't because this was a crime against humanity. It was because the smell was irritating to the white population.
In many African communities, there's this reverence for the ancestors and this reverence for those who are now in the spirit world, a belief that they are watching over. And I think that that is what sustained so many people at their weakest and their lowest moment.
On Sullivan's Island, the English established a pest house where they could quarantine people off of incoming ships.
These people were thought of as goods, as cargo. And in the language of the slave trader, this was a place where goods were held until they could reach full market value. This is the perfect example of the inhumanity of the slave system.
The most valuable workers were men younger than 20. And the second most valuable were women younger than 20. Children were young and inexpensive, and they would grow up and live a long time and produce a lot of rice.
For a person just arriving, you know you've been aboard this ship for a long time, but you probably don't know exactly how long. You don't know where you have gone. Of course, the number one thing on your mind is, how do I get out of here? How do I get myself free?
Those who died were probably buried in mass graves. The people who had died en route were probably one quarter to one third of those who had actually boarded the ship. Those who finally survived were taken to Charleston, where they were waxed down with oil, fed a good meal, and then put on the auction block.
For the enslaved, survival took many forms. Some pretended to be ignorant or represented their master's interests. However, many refused to conform. They maintained their dignity by drawing strength from their spirituality and culture.
Even though people may not have spoken the same language, and even though people may have been rivals traditionally in their homelands, there would have been a certain spiritual bonding that took place, that people came together and fused themselves together in this new world.
By the 1720s, enslaved black people outnumbered whites by more than 2-1 in the Carolina Lowcountry.
Slavery was probably unique in every region where it flourished: Massachusetts, New York, Virginia, and Barbados. But in South Carolina, it was probably the most industrial form. of slavery because the scale was so great. The task system was something that was unique to South Carolina, whereby enslaved people had a given assignment on each day. So they usually went to work in the morning at sunrise, and a day's task in the field would be to hoe a quarter of an acre, which was 105 feet square. And people spent most of the year up to their knees in mud, bent over tilling away at the soil under the sun. Rice was a very demanding master.
In South Carolina, slaves are worked almost to death, and then they go back to Africa and they go get some more, and they are continually replenished.
In Central Africa, men generally don't do agricultural work. There's even a proverb: if you want to humiliate another man, you say, "You're no man, take up a hoe," indicating that only women would do this kind of work. And yet here in South Carolina, men were being forced to work right alongside of women.
In West Africa, the mother would pound a little bit of rice every day to prepare the evening meal. It was an art form. It was a skill. You could be proud of it. You then found yourself doing the same thing. You're growing rice, but now it's completely different.
Leboy, I call you.
Oh,
Leboy. Leboy, I call you.
The sound of the pounding of rice in Africa was the sound of domesticity, but the sound of pounding rice in South Carolina was the sound of exploitation.
Well, the more money that the white elite made, the more it was in their interest to make the slave system a kind of invincible fortress that would perpetuate the comforts of the few. And so the incentive was for those who ran the society to set up extensive policing systems.
A slave, especially under these circumstances, wants to survive, wants to be free. And it also doesn't take much imagination to understand the anger of being enslaved, of being held against your will, seeing your loved one subjected to treatment that no human beings ought to experience.
The first time, your punishment was whipping. If you ran away a second time, there would be an R branded on your right cheek. The third time, one of your ears would be severed, and another R would be burned onto your left cheek for runaway. And if you ran away a fourth time, if you were a man, the punishment was castration.
Gruesome punishments that had been familiar in England were exaggerated in the slave society. The planter had to calculate that I can punish this person even if they die. I can import new people from West Africa, and I'm making so much money in this process that I can afford to do it.
The inhumane treatment says a lot. that indeed they're resisting their enslavement, that like any other human being whose rights and opportunities are being taken away, that they're going to resist and fight back.
Burning down barns was something that occurred regularly and increased during harvest time when the workload was heaviest. Poisoning could not be caught readily, and it was often something that was feared by whites even when it didn't exist.
One symptom of their fear was that there was a law that white men had to carry guns when they went to church. Sunday was the only day off for enslaved people. And so people, the white folks, feared that the uprising, if it ever came, would happen on Sunday when all the whites were gathered in church. Therefore, the white men were required to carry their guns to church.
It was on a Saturday night, September 1739. It was a work crew. Many of them are Angolans, including a man named Jemmy, who becomes the leader.
Fated Sunday finally came on the Stono River, southwest of Charleston. And they got to a store and broke in and they killed a Mr. Hutchinson. Decapitated him and put his head on a pole and cleared out his store of guns.
It happens in harvest time, which is the time when blacks are being worked the hardest. It also happens in malaria time, and there is an epidemic going on in Charleston, which has virtually shut down the town.
They must have realized that they couldn't possibly take over the area and drive out the Europeans, but they did recognize the possibility that if they took common action as soldiers, they might be able to escape.
The governor of Florida had already issued a decree that any African who was a slave who made it to Florida would be free, and there was indeed a colony there of ex-slaves.
There is this African manned fortification, and when the Stono Rebellion breaks out, it becomes clear that what these people are trying to do is to reach Fort Mosé.
People begin to join them. They burn successive plantations, kill some of the white people living there, draw some of the blacks with them. Others are afraid to join in and refuse to go. But unfortunately for them, they meet the lieutenant governor riding north.
They gave chase to him, but he was able to sound the alarm. And then, of course, a posse is formed, and they set out after this group of Africans.
It's an amazing moment. If they had been able to take him hostage, who knows what the dynamics would have been. These people are pursued south for a day or two. If they had been able to go another 24 or 48 hours so that more people could have joined them, their strength would have been greater. And who knows what the prospects would have been.
And the whites came on them. They surrounded these men and they fired on them. A lot of them were scattered. Many of them were killed.
Some of them escaped into the swamp, but those that they did capture, they chopped their heads off and put their heads on poles leading up down what is today U.S. 17 out of Charleston to send a message to the other Africans. This is what will happen to you. If you rebel.
After the Stono Rebellion, all of the separate laws governing slavery were consolidated into a single code. This Black Code restricted the movement of black people and regulated almost every aspect of the lives of the enslaved.
The crushing of the Stono Rebellion was a tragedy. To me, these people were freedom fighters. Someone like Jemmy, newly arrived from Angola, is able to show others around him that this is not the only way to live. This can change. It may not change this time, but it will change in the future.
Under the most inhumane conditions that you can possibly imagine, people were able to maintain their human dignity. It gives you some insight into the resilience of the human spirit, that it is possible for human beings to make the decision, I will not be defeated.
Next time, America's
For 100 years, the enslaved had been trapped in a brutal system. Resistance was always dangerous. At the outbreak of the American Revolution, liberty was in the air. But black people, both enslaved and free, learned that for their voices to be heard, they would have to ignite their own freedom struggle. New York City, 1741. Quack, enslaved to a house painter, approached Fort George, the seat of British colonial rule in New York, and home to the governor.
Quack was married to the governor's cook, a slave. The governor did not like Quack's behavior and did not like when Quack came visiting. And the governor gave orders to the fort sentries that if Quack should appear, he should not be allowed entry. Quack uttered certain imprecations that he would burn the place down, but he would be with his wife. When the fort did subsequently burn down, Quack was a prime suspect.
When fires erupted in a number of other buildings, warehouses, and stores, it was clear that this was more than romance thwarted.
The cry went up, the Negroes are rising, the Negroes are rising.
Rumors of slaves organizing rebellion traveled the Atlantic seaboard. 2 years earlier, in an uprising of slaves in Stono, South Carolina, some whites were murdered. Now, white New Yorkers panicked.
Almost every adult black male who was over 14 years of age was picked up by the city constables, by the militia, and placed in jail.
As the inquiries began, Caesar, slave of a baker, was the first to be marched to the gallows. His body would hang in a public space while a conspiracy trial accused dozens of slaves and a few whites of plotting to burn down New York City and foment slave rebellion. The trial revealed bitter details about the lives of the enslaved in New York, home to the second largest slave population after Charleston, South Carolina.
There was a sense among all of these slaves that they were trapped into a system that offered no yield at all, that there was nothing
hundreds of miles to the south, a small plant is creating another economic boom. Cotton. But this one will eventually tear the nation apart. Cotton is native to tropical regions, making the southern states of the U.S. a perfect breeding ground. The value part is the soft fiber which grows tightly around the shrub's sticky seeds. There are 30 species worldwide. Growing it's no problem. But processing the fiber before it can be spun into cloth is labor-intensive, especially separating the seeds. For years, it could only be done by hand. 1 pound took an entire day. A simple patent filed on March 4, 1794 changes all that. The cotton gin. It automates the process and deeply divides the country.
The cotton gin transformed not only America, but the world. The concept of mass production using a machine just exploded everywhere.
One man can now process 50 times more cotton. Output skyrockets all over the South. In 1830, America is producing half the world's cotton. By 1850, it's nearly three quarters. Called white gold, cotton supports a new lavish lifestyle in the South. By 1850, there are more millionaires per capita in Natchez, Mississippi than anywhere else on Earth. The richest man in town owns 40,000 acres, nearly three times the size of Manhattan Island. The South is thriving on the backs of humans owning other humans. It's called slavery. The North is implicated in the South's success. The industrial North is profiting from Southern cotton, but turns a blind eye to slavery. Many of them slave owners themselves, the founding fathers assumed slavery would soon disappear. Slavery has already been abolished for 20 years in Britain, is outlawed across most of Europe. But with the cotton explosion, slavery becomes critical to the Southern economy. Each slave is now 50 times more profitable. A slave who sold for $300 before the cotton gin goes for nearly $2,000 by 1860.
People don't really realize this, but slavery was actually on the decline in the South prior to the invention of the cotton gin. But then once the cotton gin made it so practical to grow cotton, all of a sudden every farmer in the South wanted to plant as much cotton as possible.
But overproduction is destroying the land. Cotton heads west in search of fertile soil, bringing slavery with it. But anti-slavery forces in the North want to keep the frontier free. The stage is set for the first battles in the war over slavery. Cotton is changing the way Americans live. In time, it will blow the nation apart. For the South, cotton is a gold mine. Now the North wants a piece of the action. It's a partnership that makes everyone rich. Based on a new machine, the power loader. Raw cotton comes in, finished cloth goes out. All under one roof. The modern factory is born. Lowell, Massachusetts is called the City of Spindles. A textile boom town. Population explodes from 200 in 1820 to nearly 20,000 in just 15 years. More than a third of the town works in the mills. 85% are single women between 15 and 25. Harriet Robinson is 10. When her father dies, she goes to work at the mill.
I can see myself now, racing down the alley, between the spinning frames and carrying in front of me a bobbin box, bigger than I was.
Women earn money for the first time. Harriet's wages help support her family. Industrialization is changing everyone's lives.
Oh, the mill girls make good use of their money. The mortgage is lifted from the homestead. The farmhouse is painted. Mill girls help maintain widowed mothers and drunken or invalid fathers. We were paid $2 a week. Oh, how proud I was when it came to my turn to stand upon the bobbin box.
When women really joined the workforce in the cotton mills and the thread factories, I think it gave women an opportunity to get out, be serious about being breadwinners, and it changed the whole fabric of America.
The mills also revolutionized how Americans dress. Mass production of cheap cotton fabrics spawns America's clothing industry. Previously, most families made their own clothes. Now people buy ready-to-wear. Eastern fashions replace buckskin. By 1850, men's clothing is the largest manufacturing industry in New York City.
For me, what makes me proudest to be an American is that American spirit of productivity, optimism. This idea that the world doesn't have to be doom and gloom, that we can use technology to make our lives better.
Fashion isn't the only innovation to come out of the mills. Technology developed here will lead straight to Silicon Valley. Looms pioneer punch cards to produce patterned fabric. Each hole in the card tells the loom to use a different colored thread. A yes-no decision. It's binary code, the basis of all modern computers. The birth of the computer and internet began in cotton mills with these looms.
You know, in every major development, I think, in the history of America, technology has been at the center of it.
Despite 12-hour shifts, the factories offer a new world of opportunity for women. They're reading more, talking more, educating themselves.
Yeah, reading books on factory time was against the rules. But we hid books in apron pockets and waste baskets. Oh, and sometimes we pasted sums on our moons to memorize.
And for the first time in America, their voices are heard. October 1836. Women from the Lowell Mills gather after work and organize. Their protest against wage cuts is one of the first strikes in U.S. history. And they will win. The mill bosses back down. A generation of young women go on to become teachers, writers, and even college graduates. Harriet Robinson will become a leading suffragette and testify before Congress. They're the first wave in a movement that results in women getting the vote. Their secret meetings at night are only possible with the light from lamps powered by an extraordinary creature.
Okay, I'm back. Well, I'm going to reserve further comment on everything we've heard on my final response show to Renegade here in the next few days. Not sure what day that will be exactly. However, I will also further elaborate on the link that this show is in reference to as well, and get into some figures. And now that we know how Bill Rice operates, well, yeah, you've heard me make the analogy of him to Green Acres and Mr. Haney. So what I'm going to do for the rest of the show is I'm going to play some Green Acres. And I'll wrap up the issues that you heard tonight on the next show. So I'm going to go ahead and play the intro to Green Acres Okay, some of you young people may not know what this show is. You probably will after hearing this. And then I'm going to play about a 5.5-minute clip of Mr. Haney. And you should be able to correlate, now that you understand Bill Rice, you should be able to correlate Bill Rice to Mr. Haney. So here is the lead-in song that's on every episode of Green Acres.
Manhattan, just give me that countryside.
New York is where I'd rather stay. I get allergic smelling hay. I just adore a penthouse view. Darling, I love you, but give me Park Avenue.
The chores.
The chores.
Fresh air.
Times Square.
You are my wife.
Okay, here's that 5.5-minute clip of Mr. Haney. And again, Mr. Haney is played by a Jew whose name is Paul Buttram. I kid you not, Buttram. All right, here we go.
And now for the news. In Chicago, the lawyers for the Birnbacher estate continue their search for any direct descendant of the pig that was the famous Birnbacher trademark, Herman.
Carl, you're supposed to be practicing... Herman. Did he say Herman?
So far, 50 pigs have claimed to be Herman's legal heir, but all have turned out to be imposters, including a fat dog who was wearing a pig suit. If there is a pig anywhere in this country who can prove he is Herman's heir, he'd better come forward. He has less than 30 days to make his claim. And now, here's tomorrow's weather report.
Seemed to me my grandfather had a pig named Herman. I come over here to talk to you legal. You're still a lawyer, ain't you?
Yes.
Ain't been disbarred or nothing.
No. What's the problem?
I think Arnold is an inheritor.
An inheritor?
What did he inheritate?
Inheritate?
Don't he know them legal terms?
But I assume that what you're trying to say is that Arnold inherited... he inherited... Somebody left him something.
They sure did. $20 million.
$20 million?
Now can he sit on the couch?
No. Does this have any connection with that story Eb was telling us about some nut named Birnbacher who left all his money to a pig?
Well, that guy wasn't a nut. He was a paranoid.
Well, whatever he was, you think Bacon Bait here is heir to the estate?
Yep. Doris and me think that Arnold is a direct descendant of Herman.
He's the pig that has his picture in the pork package.
Yes, I saw it.
Now, here's what I want you to do. Since I can't leave here, I want you to take Arnold, go to Chicago, do your legal stuff, get that money and fetch it back here.
Look, I...
Be sure to count it so they don't shortchange you.
May we just slow down a minute here? You're assuming that Arnold is related to this Herman. Hmm? Do you have any proof?
My card.
Mr. Haney, tracer of lost pig hairs. Oh.
There is your answer, Oliver. Mr. Haney can help you to find out about Arnold's ancestors.
I accept the case. Now, if I can have your check for $5,000.
What?
That's the standard pig tracer fee as set by the Pig Tracers of America. Or is it sometimes called the PTA? Can I have the money?
How can you prove that Arnold is related to Herman?
It's simple. I use the blood sample comparison method. Now, if you'll just step to the back of my mobile laboratory... I call it that because it was given to me by one of my grateful clients, mobile.
Brother.
That's just a little joke I use before escorting people to the back of the truck. It sort of takes the tension out of the air.
It works. I don't feel as tense as I did.
There it is. The famous Buell-Wacker blood comparer.
That's one of those fortune-telling machines you find in a...
I introduce my assistant, the wax model of Cornelia Buell-Wacker, who invented the machine.
How do you do?
What are you saying?
Now, this machine works on the theory that blood is thicker than water. Now, by placing a sample of the Tracy's blood into the machine, then... putting a dime into the slot, and automatically, the machine will match up the blood of the tracee and the tracer. Now, since Arnold is a member of the hog family, Miss Buell-Wacker has been programmed for pig blood, which, as you know, contains 40% more suet than human blood.
Mr. Haney, if you don't get that penny arcade machine out of here...
Penny arcade? I believe I detect a tear in Miss Buell-Wacker's eye. Hey, if you're not interested in the scientific approach, how about a reliable witness who can testify that he knows positively that Arnold is a direct descendant of Herman?
And who would that be?
My card...
Mr. Haney, professional pig witness?
For $10,000, I will be willing to get on the witness stand and swear under oath that I know for a fact that Arnold is Herman's great-grandson.
Oliver, give him the money.
That would be perjury.
It would? Well, in that case, my fee would be $20,000.
Goodbye, Mr. Haney.
Come on, Cornelia. I'll take you back to the arcade before they miss you.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and wrap up the show with a song, and we'll pick up with one final show and my response and reply, etc., and regarding Leaving Renegade. So until next time.